On Sunday, March the 23rd, 5,000 Americans will die. That many, in the 24 hours that make up this day, 5,000 of them, of natural causes, of accidents, by murders, by suicides. We won't know most of those who die on a given day, but nearly all of us have been touched in some way by death. We've had the phone call. We've felt the grief and the emptiness. We've lived with a dull ache that can't be soothed or sedated or seduced away until it has had its way with us. We don't like that memory. We don't like to talk about death or hear others talk about it. It is a foregone conclusion, I told myself, that this will not be a popular sermon. No run, I should think, on the tape library. The topic is depressing. We begin to shift uncomfortably in our seats. But since we do not, cannot live at our best until we face the fact of our own mortality, the Bible encourages the pulpit to address itself once in a while to the certainty of death and how that affects the nature of life. And what better time than on the Sunday of what the church calls Holy Week, the week in which Jesus of Nazareth died young and wrongfully on a pair of crossed tree limbs. I am a Protestant, not much given to candles and bells and beads, but I feel a certain sympathy for those who think it is good at the start of Lent to remind themselves of their own mortality by a ritual in which their foreheads are marked with ashes and they hear the words, "Dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return." Symbol of a central conviction in most religions of the world that you have to become starkly aware of your own death, your own inevitable death, in order to live life at its best. If you were to ask me what I find most frustrating sometimes, when I look out at my students day after day, I would not speak of absence of intellect. They are bright enough. Nor an absence of neatness, good looks, good health. Most of them are rich in those things. What it would be, and I can never stop wondering at it, is an absence of awe and reverence for the act of living, for the excitement and potential of being alive. I think it has something to do with the fact that most of them have not measured life by death, have never had deep emotional reason to say, "It is not just grandfather or Aunt Kate in Minnesota who will die. I will die." Life really does not last long. It is infinitely precious. What am I going to do with it? This kind of knowledge is not easy to come by in America. We need no book or sermon to tell us that mainstream American culture is deeply death-denying. We became so conscious of this about 15 years ago that courses in death and dying sprang up everywhere. Every kid I knew seemed to be taking a course in high school or college on death and dying. It was a minor revolution, and it seems to be over, defeated by all those factors in American life that keep us from confronting death as a naked reality. It is not hard to know what they are. For one thing, relatively few families anymore experience the death of a child at an early age. I am a tourist in old cemeteries, and the one inescapable truth I see there is that almost every family 100 years ago lost not one, but two or more children before they could grow up. Other children in such a family learned about death early, and they learned it firsthand because there were no specialists to shield them from its impact. The child usually died at home, was readied for burial at home, was honored perhaps by a wake, during which some member of the family sat in a room with the dead until it was time for the funeral. Under such circumstances, it was brought home to everybody that death was real and close, that this will also happen to me. By and by, we reaped a rich harvest from medical advances, and it became uncommon for young children to die. When death came to young or old, it began more and more to come inside a strange room, inside a hospital, with no witnesses except a nurse or a doctor. We became so mobile, we lived so far from one another, that we escaped day-to-day contact with aging and dying relatives, including our own parents. If we happened to live in the same town, there were separate communities for people who were getting old, not just nursing homes, but retirement centers as well, to shield us even from the signs of failing strength. More and more we were isolated from what it means to die. By now, about 75% of those who die are routinely processed out of existence through the crowded corridors of busy institutions. Experts handle death efficiently. It is no longer a metaphysical mystery, a summons from God, or even a raw, crude fact. It is an engineering problem for those who manage death. The physician, mortician, statistician, even in only slightly less technical ways, the minister. All the designated supervisors of nature's planned obsolescence for the nation that designed the disposable diaper and the non-deposit beer bottle, the dead became only a bit more troublesome than any other form of human waste. And the farther we got from it, the more uneasy it made us when we had to face it. Even in the disguised shapes made possible by modern technology. The best proof of this lies in the way we evade the reality of death by the language we use. It is too painful to say someone died, so we have a storehouse of euphemisms. John passed away, departed, expired. We lost Uncle Ned, we explain, as if somehow he had only been misplaced and might be found again. Anything to avoid the brutal fact. There are men who cannot say to their wives, "When I die, you will need to do these things." They say, "If something should happen to me," leaving it open, as if there might be some doubt. The graveyard sounded grim, so it became a cemetery, until that too carried too solemn a sound, and we switched to Memorial Garden with all its lovely connotations of memory and the beguiling hint that this is actually a place of life and growing things. An insurance man tells me he is taught to say, not how will your family be taken care of if you should die tomorrow? That raises too much fear and anxiety. But how would your family be taken care of if you had died yesterday? But you didn't, you see. So you can relax. You've been offered a comfortable impossibility. The man did not ask me once, do you wish to buy a grave? He asked if I would like to invest, good capitalistic word, in a pre-need memorial estate. I've learned as a minister not to ask the mortician where burial will be. That word is too final. Where, I ask when they call me, will interment be? Safe, antiseptic term. You don't sign a death certificate. That can be upsetting and bring you face to face with a bitter and unwelcome truth. You sign the vital statistics form. Vital. The word breathes of life. It comforts. By pretending to be something other than what it is. Pretense. Denial. In the spirit, I suppose, of that husband-wife mortician team down in Oklahoma, many years ago, who stood one at the head and one at the foot of my father's coffin, and with what they meant as a kindly smile, said, doesn't he look natural? My wiry, tough father, with an evening beard that scratched like coarse sandpaper on a little boy's cheek, transformed into a wax doll with rouge and lipstick. I had to grit my teeth to keep from shouting, my God, no, he doesn't look natural. And why should he? Except that we are conspiring to keep him from looking like what he is, which is dead. Well, I may seem to have all this well in hand right now, but that's only because I'm looking back. The truth is that I went into a kind of emotional tailspin after my father died. And I don't think for a minute now that it was because I was preoccupied with my father. We had enjoyed a good relationship. We had laughed and played and shared things. I had no guilt feelings. What I think happened, and I had a letter this very week from a man to whom it is happening, is that through his death, I became aware, came face to face for the first time, even after 3 years in war, with my own mortality. This was my father. For so long, supremely wise and strong, the final defense against all serious problems. And my father was dead. If my father could die, so could I. And I would. I had a shock reaction to all that. And when I came out on the other side of it, I had some different feelings about death and life than I had ever had before. An emotional acceptance this time, an emotional acceptance of the truth of dying. We all know it intellectually. None of us would get it wrong on a true-false test. What is different is to pinch yourself and say, this consciousness will one day cease to be. But if you do, the quality of life changes forever. Each day becomes priceless and therefore beautiful and exciting. You get over the illusion that you have an infinite amount of time, that you can put off doing the great thing you plan, put off living until after graduation or after a career or after you get financial security. You get over being trapped by your own culture. We judge ourselves by the standards around us. If we seem to achieve in terms of those standards, we're puffed up. If we seem to fail, we are crushed. And yet, how little most of it matters. Our identity does not depend on the distinctions insisted upon by the culture around us. Someone will surely object, but Bob, to think of such things is so morbid. Well, I have found it quite otherwise. Earnest confrontation with the fact of my own mortality makes me know that time is too precious to be spent even being morbid. I don't stop planning things. I just find the frame of reference changed in which they are chosen and worked on. I don't start each day in a kind of crazy living for the moment, but I do try living in the moment, described once as a way of being gracefully present even to the simplest joys and labors. So death, this death, Jesus died 2,000 years ago, and millions of his fellows have died since, emerges as a teacher of wisdom. My students often read a great short story by Tolstoy called The Death of Ivan Ilyich. It is one of the most depressing stories ever written, except that read as it was meant to be read, depression is not the final result. When we read it, we go through all the stages of dying. We suffer with Ivan until we feel we cannot bear it anymore. We confront such examination of our values that we want to throw away the book and run outside to play. But the reading Tolstoy intended inevitably makes you want to live more fully. Life itself turns into a miracle. Simple sunlight, dancing leaves, tender grass, water rippling under the breath of wind, a child laughing two houses away, a bird sweeping like a blue arrow across the backyard, magic available to anyone who takes time to see. And once truly aware of your own mortality, you will take time to see. The famous psychologist Abraham Maslow had a near fatal heart attack once, after which he wrote these words: "The confrontation with death and the reprieve from it makes everything look so precious, so sacred, so beautiful, that I feel more strongly than ever the impulse to love it, to embrace it, to let myself be overwhelmed by it. My river has never looked so beautiful. Death and its ever-present possibility makes love, passionate love, possible. Those who love best have learned the meaning of death. Does it belong to the church and the pulpit, this thing I am trying to speak? The answer is clearly yes. God instructed us from the beginning in the way of wisdom, dust thou art, to dust thou shalt return. Especially in that striking word from the great 90th Psalm. So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Count the days. Know how few they are. Discover in deep emotional ways that they are finite, that at some point there is not going to be another one, and you will learn how to live. I think I saw someone discover that the other day. When I walked down the aisle of this church, after a memorial service, a man I had never seen, sitting right over there, reached out and caught hold of my arm. He didn't know how else to stop me, so he said, "Pastor," and that did it. "Pastor, I just want to tell you that in all my life, I have never gone to a funeral before where, when it ended, I wanted to applaud. And I wish I had." Now, I knew what he meant. He was not talking about my delivery or the organ music. He had felt in the room, because of marvelous material provided to me by the family, the challenge of life. He wanted to go away from the building and live. And that is why the verse in Ecclesiastes says, "It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to heart." The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. It is strange and troubling advice. It runs against all our instincts. We'd rather disguise death, hide from it, stay away from the funeral. But if the Bible is right, we are wrong. Because if we go wisely, the result is not depression and morbidity. The result is life. Knowing beyond all doubt that the terms of our stay are what they are, we understand exactly what the old poet said next. "Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might." In the name of the Lord of life, amen.